Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, today's workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Candace, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Advances in the Treatment of Gastric Cancer. And this is a very important program. It's long awaited by many of you, and it's a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of your interest in the program and our collaboration in terms of helping to spread the word that we have over 464 participants on the call today. And you come from all over the United States, and we also have a number of international participants from Canada, China, Japan, Morocco, New Zealand, United Kingdom, Algeria, and Vietnam. So you really come from all over the world. I have to say this is really a global call. Now, today's program is supported by Gilead, a grant from Genentech, a contribution from Lilly, and an independent educational grant from Merck & Company, Inc. And I really want to thank them for their collaborative effort in making today's program possible. Now, we really have the best speakers on our program today, really wonderful speakers. And I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Al Benson III. Dr. Benson is Professor of Medicine, Associate Director for Cooperative Groups, Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center, Northwestern University. And Dr. Benson is going to provide an overview of gastric cancer, diagnosing and staging, and standard of care, including chemotherapy and the role of targeted treatments. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Benson.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and it's a pleasure to join everyone today to discuss this important topic. And I'm going to try to give you some highlights discussing the subjects that Dr. Messner just mentioned. When we talk about upper gastrointestinal cancers, we're often referring to the esophagus, particularly the lower esophagus near the stomach, what's known as the gastroesophageal junction, where the stomach and esophagus join, as well as the stomach. In Western countries, including the United States, gastroesophageal junction cancers, which also include the first part of the stomach, known as the gastric cardia, are increasing in incidence, and the most common location for this type of cancer. Since World War II, we've actually seen decreases in incidence of gastric cancer in the United States. However, in other countries, this is not the same. For example, in China, there is the highest incidence of gastric cancer in the world, as well as very predominant in other Asian countries such as Japan and Korea. We also see high incidence of stomach cancer in Chile, Peru, Brazil, as well as Eastern Europe. Over a million people in the world are diagnosed each year with gastric cancer, making it the fifth most common cancer, and it's actually the third cause of cancer mortality around the world, representing about 10% of all cancer deaths. So you can see this is a really important worldwide health problem. We do know there are associated causes of gastric cancer, which may vary depending on where you live around the world. So, for example, in South America, infection with H. pylori, a bacteria, is commonly associated with the development of gastric cancer. But also other causes such as smoking, high salt intake, and there are dietary patterns around the world where this is so, with exposure to nitrates and nitrates, as well as heavy alcohol use. Now, there are people who have an inherited predisposition for gastric cancer, but it's actually uncommon, less than 5%. And then there's another 5 to 10% of people who have a familial association. An example of an inherited type of gastric cancer is what's known as the Lynch syndrome. This is often associated with colon cancer, which can occur at a young age, but also it's linked to gastric cancer. In many of these inherited cancer situations, people are diagnosed at a young age. I was asked to just briefly mention staging. So the typical staging system we use is referred to as the TNM system, that T for tumor, N for lymph nodes, and M for metastases. And this can be performed in terms of clinical staging, where we use scans and so forth to estimate the stage, but the most accurate staging is what occurs at surgery when the pathologist has the opportunity to review the surgical specimen. Unfortunately, about half of people present with advanced disease. So many of these individuals are not candidates for surgery, although we certainly look carefully for a person who might benefit from surgical intervention. Even those who can go to surgery, the majority will have positive lymph nodes at that time. We have a number of diagnostic tools. These include, for example, endoscopic ultrasound, CT scans, MRIs, PET scans, and the use of what's called laparoscopic surgical staging. And this may be very important for people. For example, if we want to make sure there's no evidence of what's referred to as carcinomatosis, which means literally small seeds of tumor throughout the abdomen, which we might not see with our current imaging techniques. It is also critical to emphasize that the treatment of gastric cancer and evaluation requires a multidisciplinary team. This includes medical, radiation, and surgical oncologists, as well as radiologists, gastroenterologists, and pathologists. It's also important in terms of surgery, and we've learned this through careful observation, is this type of surgery requires a very skilled surgeon. We've also learned that surgical techniques are important, and we've learned particularly from our Asian colleagues that the extent of a lymph node dissection is very, very important. It requires a very skilled surgeon and can have a very important impact on outcome for patients. In terms of integration of other types of surgery, other types of treatment with surgery. For example, in Japan and also previously in other countries, surgery was the preferred first step, followed by chemotherapy after surgery. There is now a trend around the world to use what's called neoadjuvant treatment, which is a preoperative treatment approach, often with both chemotherapy and radiation. And the type of drugs we consider in this setting include combinations with drugs such as paclitaxel and carboplatin, 5-FU and cisplatin, or oxaliplatin and 5-FU. After this treatment, patients then proceed for surgery. Often after surgery in this situation, patients do not receive additional therapy. And part of the reason for that is studies have shown that it is more difficult for people to complete this type of surgery, this type of treatment after a successful surgery. For metastatic or advanced gastric cancer, there are a number of possible regimens, usually given as two drug combinations. We've also learned that we can incorporate biological therapies as part of the treatment regimen. And in one case, we have identified a specific tumor marker that is linked to a specific drug. This marker is referred to as the human epidermal growth factor receptor 2 gene, also known as HER2. And gastric cancer patients who express this gene within their tumors can benefit from the biological therapy known as trastuzumab. This represents an important advance in treatment, as it first did in breast cancer, where we first learned the importance of HER2 and the fact that we can utilize a therapy that will benefit patients who express HER2. About 20% of people will express HER2 in terms of tumor evaluation, so this treatment cannot be used for everyone. It's also mostly associated with what's known as the intestinal type of gastric cancer, and less often noted in what's referred to as diffuse type gastric cancer. The trastuzumab, by the way, is usually given in combination with two chemotherapy drugs. Now, there's another targeted therapy that has been developed for gastric cancer, and this is referred to as a VEGFR2 antibody and is named ramucirumab. Unfortunately, we do not have a targeted marker when we evaluate patients' tumors for use of ramucirumab. Nonetheless, in clinical trials, for patients who have received previous therapy for metastatic disease, ramucirumab can be beneficial. Ramucirumab can be given by itself, or it can be given in combination with chemotherapy. As I mentioned, there are many treatments for gastric cancer. So, for example, what we refer to as first-line therapy or initial therapy for people who are diagnosed with metastatic disease. First, it's, as mentioned, critical to determine if a patient's tumor expresses HER2, because those individuals should be considered for trastuzumab plus chemotherapy. For all others, we have a number of chemotherapy drugs we can consider, and these include capecitabine, 5-FU, cisplatin, oxaliplatin, paclitaxel, docetaxel, and irinotecan. And there are a variety of ways we can combine these drugs, and as I mentioned, we usually give these as two drug combinations. As I also mentioned, for people who've had first-line therapy, but now must have a second-line treatment, clinical trials have shown the benefits of drugs such as paclitaxel, docetaxel, irinotecan, and, of course, ramucirumab. I want to conclude to just mention that there is tremendous interest in immunotherapy, and there are ongoing trials looking at drugs which are known as immune checkpoint agents, and these include pembrolizumab and nivolumab, and we may hear a little bit more about those drugs. In addition, the Cancer Genome Atlas has redefined gastric cancer into four distinct subclasses of disease. And by knowing this, we may be able to develop other therapies that will improve outcomes for our patients. That was a very quick review, but I appreciate your attention. And Dr. Messner, back to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Benson. That was wonderful and a terrific overview of gastric cancer and really presenting really state-of-the-art treatment as well as new things on the horizon. So thank you. I know there'll be questions for you and for all of our speakers during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Jeffrey Koo. Dr. Koo is medical oncologist, assistant attending physician, gastrointestinal service, Department of Medicine, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Koo is going to address new treatment approaches, precision medicine, predicting response to treatment, and the role of clinical trials. It's really my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Koo.
Carolyn, thank you so much, and you know, thank you very much for the kind invitation to address the audience. I would also want to thank Dr. Benson for his excellent summary, which is a great jumping off point for my discussion. So I think, you know, in terms of starting out and talking about new directions, I would like to momentarily focus on, you know, the current standard of care that Dr. Benson discussed. The first, of course, is the role of trastuzumab. And as he pointed out, this is only an option for the 20 to 25% of tumors that express the HER2 protein. So trastuzumab was approved in combination with chemotherapy in 2010. And since then, we've really tried to make advances by looking at other medications that can block this HER2 protein. And we've really essentially taken the playbook from breast cancer, where HER2 is also present in about 20 to 25% of tumors, and run with it. But the results have largely been disappointing. So specifically, drugs that are able to effectively block HER2, drugs other than trastuzumab and that are routinely used in breast cancer, really, for the most part, have not proven to be effective. There is one study that's pending, but at this point, we really haven't built on drugs against HER2 in the last 6 or 7 years. The other drug, or the other targeted therapy that Dr. Benson mentioned, is a drug called ramucirumab, which targets something called VEGFR2. But kind of broadly speaking, this is what's called an anti-angiogenic therapy. And what it means is that we think that these drugs help to block the formation of new blood vessels, and tumor cells, because they grow very quickly, need a rich blood supply. So they are able to essentially trick the body into making new blood vessels for them. And this class of medications helps to block that and essentially helps to starve the cancer cells. So ramucirumab was FDA approved in 2014, and it's approved either on its own or in combination with paclitaxel chemotherapy. But specifically, it's approved in the second-line setting, meaning that the cancer cells have to have grown on one chemotherapy before patients are eligible to receive this drug. The kind of biggest advance in evaluating this medication is the thought that, well, if it works in the second-line setting, in other words, if the cancer cells have already grown on one treatment, maybe it works just as well or even better if we give it with first-line chemotherapy. In other words, the first choice of chemotherapy for someone where the cancer has recurred or where it already spread at the time of diagnosis. So there's a study that I believe has completed. This is a global study involving hundreds of patients. And hopefully in a year or so, we'll know whether these results are positive. Having said that, there was a smaller study performed here in the U.S. looking at ramucirumab in the first-line setting, which unfortunately didn't show any benefit, but we'll have to wait to see whether the larger study shows a benefit. So, you know, these really have been kind of the most advanced treatments that have been available over the last several years. But as Dr. Benson mentioned, probably the most exciting area of advancement comes from the use of immunotherapy. So these are drugs that they're called immune checkpoint inhibitors. But essentially what they do is that they take the brakes off the immune system. So the immune system wakes up, recognizes the tumor cells, and then is able to attack the tumors themselves. So this is an idea that's been floating around literally for about a century. But it wasn't until, I believe, 2010 that the first medication was approved for the treatment of melanoma, which is a kind of skin cancer. Since then, studies and investigations into this area really have grown exponentially, and now these drugs are approved for multiple cancers, including melanoma, bladder cancer, lung cancer, and probably many members of the audience will have seen ads for these drugs on TV. So these drugs are also undergoing what we call phase 3 evaluation in esophageal and stomach cancer, meaning that they are undergoing kind of the last stage of evaluation to try to prove that they're effective. And if so, these drugs will end up being FDA approved. The one exciting piece of news is that at one of the major conferences this past January in San Francisco, the Gastrointestinal Cancer Symposium, there were the results of a study that was done in East Asia involving almost 500 patients with a drug called nivolumab. So these patients with gastric cancer had received at least two previous chemotherapy treatments, and they were chosen to receive either nivolumab or a placebo by a flip of an electronic coin. The results did show that the nivolumab drug was superior to a placebo, and in particular, for patients who had received many, many treatments, approximately one, or a little bit more than one in four patients was alive 12 months after receiving the treatment. And that's a, significant breakthrough, considering the fact that many of these patients had received all of the commercially available chemotherapy drugs. Now, I would caution that this study was done only in East Asian patients. It did not have any U.S. patients, and therefore, for the purposes of FDA approval, probably is not sufficient. But there are other studies with very similar drugs, including a drug called pembrolizumab, which have enrolled U.S. as well as Western European patients. And I think the likelihood there is that, one or several of these drugs will be approved for gastric cancer, hopefully in the next 1 to 1.5 years. That, of course, is a long time, but there's certainly also an explosion of clinical studies, which I will get to. So the next area I would like to talk about is the idea of personalized medicine. This can mean any number of things, but in general, all of us would ideally like to conceive of the somewhat science fiction notion of being able to do very detailed tests of the tumor cells to find out exactly what the weakness or the Achilles heel of the tumor cell is, and therefore for us literally to customize a treatment that's individual for each patient. Unfortunately, this really, I mean, the science fiction element or the hype has not met the reality. At this point in gastric cancer, we probably only have two markers that can help us to figure out who is more likely to benefit from a treatment. The first is HER2, which Dr. Benson discussed. Again, HER2 is a protein that's found only in about 20 to 25% of gastric tumors, and we think it's only this proportion of gastric tumors that benefit from trastuzumab. So therefore, it is a kind of black and white picture in the sense that if the tumor cells are HER2 positive, patients should absolutely receive trastuzumab at some point. If the tumor cells are HER2 negative, then they derive no benefit from trastuzumab. So this is probably the only kind of black and white, what we call a biomarker. The other biomarker that I can think about is something that's being increasingly used for the immunotherapy drugs that I discussed, and it's another protein called PD-L1. PD-L1 appears to be present in about 40% of gastric cancer cells, and when the PD-L1 is present, the tumors are more likely to shrink, and patients are more likely to benefit from the immunotherapy drugs. On the other hand, unlike HER2, which is more or less a black and white situation, this is really shades of gray. What I mean by that is that tumors that are PD-L1 positive are more likely to benefit than tumors that are PD-L1 negative, but it's definitely not 100%. So PD-L1 negative tumors can still benefit. So this is definitely a bit more of a mixed picture than the HER2 story. The last kind of test that's being increasingly done, and many in the audience may have heard of it or may have even requested it, is what we call next generation sequencing. And the idea here is that we are looking at genes within the tumor cells to try to find out, which of these genes are mutated and may therefore act as kind of driving forces for the cancer cells. There are now commercially available tests, and many academic institutions also have their own version of the test. The problem with the next generation sequencing is that it hasn't turned out to be as helpful as we would have hoped. We and others have looked at it, and we found that maybe less than 5% of the time do we find something in the next generation sequencing results that allow us to put someone on a clinical study with an experimental drug that targets that specific weakness or mutation. This brings me really to the last topic that I would discuss, which is really clinical studies. And it's absolutely critical for patients and for their family members to discuss with their physicians, whether their clinical studies are available or to actively seek out clinical studies. So specifically, all the drugs that are available today, including trastuzumab, including ramucirumab, and certainly even including the chemotherapy drugs, many of them were developed and validated only because patients and their family members, agreed to go on clinical studies. The immunotherapy drugs, which hopefully will be FDA approved in the not too distant future, they've been developed through clinical studies. And at this point, if there is a gap between when we know that the drugs are effective and when they become commercially available, there are many other clinical studies that are available, including immunotherapy drugs, that patients would have access to. Lastly, certainly, if patients have genetic testing done on the tumor cells, and if a specific mutation pops up, frequently the only way to try to attack that is by going on a clinical study. So certainly, my strong encouragement would be for patients to think about studies and to discuss them with their physicians. And I think with that, I'll end.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Koo. That was excellent and very comprehensive in terms of presenting on some of the new approaches and also the important role of clinical trials. So thank you. And I know there will be questions for you as well during the Q&A. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Tanyos Bakai-Saab. Dr. Bakai-Saab is co-leader, Gastrointestinal Cancer Program, Mayo Clinic Cancer Center, Senior Associate Consultant, Division of Hematology and Oncology at Mayo Clinic. And Dr. Bakai-Saab is going to address how research contributes to your treatment options, controlling symptoms, side effects, and pain, and the importance of communicating with your healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's now my pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Bakai-Saab.
Well, thank you, and it's a pleasure to be speaking to you and to everyone. And I think my discussion is a nice segue between what you've heard from the two good doctors, and then proceeding to the other speakers. So we've heard about the importance of research and how it contributes to treatment options, and there are two types of research that contribute directly and indirectly, actually more than two types, but two types that are relevant to the discussion at least. There is the more basic type of research, which is mostly laboratory-driven, based with discoveries that eventually can translate into clinical research. Typically patients are not in direct contact with that type of research, although some of the clinical trials may have components that essentially would integrate these basic questions into research. These are important on their side. The one that certainly is going to affect directly the lives of patients is what we call clinical or clinical translational research. And these can come in different phases, from phase 0, 1, 2, 3, and then there's phase 4. Phase 1, 2, 3 are those that are most commonly made available through to patients. Phase 1 is the one that's designed mostly to understand what dose is optimal to move forward to phase 2, essentially depict the highest dose that would be tolerable and not toxic, and then look for some what we call preliminary signals, meaning early signals of activity. The phase 2 really focuses on trying to understand if the treatment holds enough promise to move to the next phase, and also understand if in a larger patient population the treatment is safe enough to move forward to the larger phase, which is the phase 3. The phase 3 is typically a comparative analysis, essentially putting what we call the standard of care, so let's say a chemotherapy regimen XY, to the investigational arm, which would be XY plus drug Z, and drug Z can be, depending on the intent of the study, a chemotherapeutic agent or a targeted agent or a selected agent. So that's how research is conducted, essentially through the different phases. So it can be quite a lengthy process, but it has to follow a lot of these steps to essentially establish new standards. Why is it important? Why and how research contributes to the treatment options? Well, I think research should be considered, as mentioned by Dr. Koo, should be considered as a standard of care whenever available. Now, why would I say that? Mostly because although we've done great strides and we continue to, and it's great times, improving care of our patients, improving their survival, we're still not where we should be. And where we should be is be able to essentially allow patients to survive the lengths of their lives, be cured, transforming this into a chronic disease where patients will not die from this cancer. And so in many ways, the way we keep on improving options is through clinical research, through research. A lot of the agents that have been discussed already, from trastuzumab to ramucirumab to the PD-1 inhibitors, they've all gone through clinical trials and the prior chemotherapy. They've all gone through clinical research trials before they become standard. So it's very important to consider research as part of the treatment options, and that's how we continue to advance the care of our patients. And also research provides options that are otherwise may not be available. So in other parts of the world, maybe not necessarily in the United States, but in other parts of the world, a lot of treatment options are not available, and they're only made available through clinical research and clinical trials. So it's also a way to access some of the life-saving drugs. So multiple reasons why research contributes significantly to treatment options. And like I said, many of the cures really started as clinical trials. The other thing about clinical research, and especially when we work with what we call the early phases of research, so the phase 1-2, is it also helps us understand the science, a lot of the science behind how these drugs work, and try to establish better standards as we move to the phase 3, and also help us understand a lot about gastric cancer. What drives it? What can stop it? And why we succeed or why we fail. So a lot of these questions can be answered through research. So in sum, if you put all these things together, you understand why it's important and why research should be a priority whenever considering care for patients with gastric cancer. Another element of research that's also very important is what we call supportive research. So understanding more and more how we can support our patients through their journey, either with chemotherapy or through their journey with the cancer, and then eventually in the more and more advanced disease as they progress through end of life, or as an earlier disease, how they end up surviving their cancers and how they live through their survivorship. So there is a lot of elements to consider. Because our treatment does not stop. When treatment stops, our care begins before and continues much after the treatment itself. So these are very important aspects of our care and our research as well. So that brings me to understanding a little bit more how we control symptoms, side effects, and pain. And this one cancer, gastric cancer, can be a tremendous burden on patients and their families. I mean, cancer overall is a tremendous burden on patients and their family, but this one in particular, because it affects a major digestive organ. It's really, an important, as Dr. Benson mentioned, it's an important organ that allows us essentially to digest food and move it forward down to the colon, etc. So this is a very key organ, and it sits in the middle of the digestive tract. And so you can imagine if there's a tumor in the stomach, that it can cause blockage. If it's large enough, it will essentially stop food from being processed and going down the system. Symptoms like nausea and vomiting, because again of the location of these tumors, they can. If not blockage, they can create difficulty in swallowing, so patients will have difficulty eating solid foods and may rely on more liquid diet, and we know we're going to talk a little bit more about nutrition and hydration concerns and tips later on. Bleeding is a concern. A lot of these tumors can cause irritation in the surface of the stomach, which can puncture into some of these blood vessels and cause bleeding. Because of all these, patients lose weight and appetite and others. So all these symptoms, and there are others, of course, are related to the cancer itself. So when we talk about symptoms, side effects, and pain, we're thinking about the symptoms that are caused by the cancer versus the side effects that may be caused by the treatment itself. And pain is mostly related to the cancer itself. So how do we control, and again, a high level understanding of how do we control a lot of these. So the most common scenarios, and let's talk first about the symptoms that are related to the cancer itself. Let's go through these one by one. and very briefly. So bleeding, for example, can be handled through in the advanced stages by removal of the stomach if the bleeding is severe. In the early stages, removal of the stomach is mostly part of the treatment. In the later stages, it's not, except when bleeding is profuse. Nausea, vomiting can be handled multiple ways. If it's related to blockage, and that brings us to blockage, there are ways where we can handle blockage either through placing stents if the blockage is not complete, doing what we call bypass surgeries in select patients, although sometimes these are difficult to do because they may delay the initiation of chemotherapy, or placing a feeding tube below the site of obstruction. If the obstruction is too low, it makes it very difficult to place feeding tubes, and we may have to think about other ways of nutrition. But the hope is, as we start these treatments, that these tumors will shrink, and eventually patients will be able to eat and drink, hopefully normally. For the difficulty in swallowing, again, mostly gets resolved by treatment, effective treatment. But as a bridge to that, we favor placing stents, which essentially means that you allow the swallowing tube to, especially in the lower part that's closer to the stomach, to allow essentially its to resume its normal function and allow food to transit through the stomach. So these are just high-level things. Now, in terms of side effects of the treatment, so although treatments can improve a lot of these symptoms, they can come with their own effects, like fatigue. For most of them, you know, on the long run at least, patients end up with significant fatigue. And with those modifications, or sometimes taking a break for some patients where there are some significant responses in accordance with their physician may help with the fatigue. There are some chemical interventions, meaning drugs, that can help with the fatigue. You know, other toxicities include numbness and tinglings, so nerve toxicity from some of the agents that may be used, like an agent called oxaliplatin or cisplatin. And these can be managed through dose interruptions or dose reductions or breaks from this type of chemo while continuing the other types of chemo that don't cause these neurotoxicity. You know, fevers are always a concern, especially with drops in the white counts, and these may mean that there is an infection or increased risk of infection, and that has to be brought to the attention of the physician, the treating oncologist. With the whole introduction of these new agents, immunotherapeutic agents, we worry about a slew of potential toxicities, although rare, that can essentially unleash the power of the immune system against some of the normal organs rather than the cancer, like the liver, the thyroid, the lungs, and others. Again, those are unusual, uncommon to be uncommon and unusual to be severe enough, but also something to consider as we treat patients with these agents. And then there is the risks of cardiac toxicity, so toxicity to the heart muscle with heart failure with drugs like ipirubicin and Herceptin or trastuzumab can cause that. But again, it's very uncommon, incredibly unusual. Most physicians know how to handle and watch for those through repeated echocardiograms and others. And there's a number of other potential toxicities from the various agents. Again, you know, we have a short time, but that's just to give you a flavor of that. In terms of pain control, you know, most large centers work very closely with palliative care doctors, doctors that specialize in pain control. You know, us oncologists, most of the times we can handle even the more severe pains, but sometimes it requires even further intervention. The pain becomes too strong, too out of control, despite maximal control attempts to control it from the oncologist's standpoint. And so you have to integrate pain doctors and palliative doctors. There are two types of pain medications, those that work on the short term and those who work on the long term, meaning long acting and short acting. Ultimately, most patients will end up on long acting agents to prevent these peaks and valleys of pain that can be incredibly uncomfortable to patients. So again, all in the hopes that chemotherapy will work or target therapy will work enough to resolve a lot of these symptoms. Finally, just a quick word about the importance of communicating with your healthcare team about quality of life concerns. And that's very important. You know, pain, fatigue, anxiety, depression, all these things can happen or do happen with cancer, and with gastric cancer more specifically, difficulty in swallowing. These are a lot of subjective symptoms. In other words, if you don't tell your doctor about them, your doctor's not going to know about them. It's very difficult to guess relating to these symptoms. That's why we consider our patients our partners in the fight. Me and their families the same. So there is no say about the importance of communication and in real-time communication about the quality of life concerns. Hey, doc, I can't swallow. Hey, doc, I'm very fatigued. I'm tired. I can barely get out of bed. Your physicians or your nurse practitioner sees you once every 2 weeks or 4 weeks. They're not with you every day. So it's important for the families and the patient to make sure, because early intervention is best. The earlier we know about your symptoms, the earlier we know about your quality of life, the better it will be for us in terms of adjusting maybe our treatment doses, or perhaps we haven't done a good job with controlling your pain and other biochemical interventions. Important for us to know about these things and don't feel that you're burdening us. It's very important for us to know about those because we can make a difference. And with that, I conclude this discussion and thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Bakai. That was really outstanding, I have to say, and really, really helpful to everyone to realize the importance of there being really, as you said, patients as partners or families as partners with the healthcare team and really letting them know how you feel. So throughout all of your treatment, that's really important. So thank you for highlighting that. And I know that there will be questions for you during the Q&A as well. So thank you. Excellent. Our next presenter is Ms. Diana Bearden. Ms. Bearden is a dietitian, and she is supervisor of clinical nutrition at University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Bearden is going to address nutrition and hydration concerns and tips, which Dr. Bakai Saab has mentioned already. But if you would like to add to that, Ms. Bearden, we really appreciate your being here. Thank you.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation, addressing the nutritional concerns with gastric cancer. So absolutely, I'll be supplementing some of the information that we've already heard this afternoon. So one of the things I always remind patients is eating well during your treatment is essential. It's essential for a number of reasons. It provides you the energy to do the things you enjoy, so quality of life is there. As well as maintaining your weight. So physically, you can maintain that normalcy as much as possible. But also, patients who maintain good nutrition tend to tolerate their treatments better and experience fewer delays in their treatment. So it's important for you, like was mentioned earlier, communicate with your team sooner than later. They don't know unless you tell them. And then they can start connecting you with ancillary staff who's there to give additional support and make unique plans for what you're going through. So some common side effects that patients may experience with gastric cancer, some of these were mentioned a little bit ago, but nausea, vomiting, a decrease in appetite, maybe changes in taste, changes in bowel function, diarrhea or constipation. You may start experiencing some increase in fatigue, or even weight changes. These are all common challenges, and they can potentially pose as barriers to meeting your nutritional goals. So constant communication, again, with your team is the best way to help your treatment be as effective as possible without any delays. So again, everyone's plan is unique, and that's oftentimes people forget that. They, you know, talk with friends and families before they'll even reach out with their healthcare team. But we've heard a list of different treatments today, different drugs, different side effects, et cetera. And so that's where the uniqueness comes in and the importance for you to talk with your team specifically about what's best to meet your needs. So just to give you some general, you know, big picture ways to address some of the side effects that I listed a minute ago, I think can be helpful, at least a place to start, and then the beginning of a conversation maybe with your doctor as well. So nausea and vomiting and poor appetite, this is very common. It can happen for a number of reasons. It can be the disease itself, like that was mentioned, or even the treatments that are provided. So one thing I remind patients is always take the medications that are prescribed to you in the time and the amount that they're prescribed in. We've heard earlier about the number of, you know, research and the trials, and there's a lot of investigation into these drugs, and they know side effects related to these drugs, and usually about the time that a patient will be experiencing them. So they're giving you medication to help reduce the impact of that side effect. But with nausea and vomiting and poor appetite, some things you can focus on if you're taking your medication as appropriately, that's the first line, smaller, more frequent meals. We don't have to sit down and eat a large plate. We can graze and snack. Packaging is very convenient now for grab-and-go portion sizes. So oftentimes that gives a little bit of ease, especially when you're on the go, going through treatments, maybe not at home all day. Focusing on nutritionally higher calorie, high protein foods. And I say this because what you're feeding your body to fuel it is very important. And an old way of looking at things is, oh, just eat anything. You know, you want 15 hamburgers, you know, whatever, cakes, candies. And there may be a time and place for that. But for the most part, we want to fuel our bodies appropriately to get the vitamins and the nutrients, the healthy fats, the lean proteins to really help it function at its optimal level. Eliminating stress at mealtime. Very important. Wearing loose-fitting clothing can help with, you know, the nausea and the vomiting as well. You just want to be very comfortable. And exercising, walking, just basic walking can be very helpful. Talk with your doctor and your medical team about what's appropriate for you. Changes in taste can be another issue, and this can set people throw a bump in the road for them because it's a lot of trial and error what tastes good. But meeting with your healthcare team, they can absolutely help direct that a little bit more specifically. But some basic guidelines is keeping a good oral hygiene, rinsing your mouth with a water and baking soda solution to help cleanse that palate, staying hydrated. It may be that trying some tart foods can help reset as well. What I find with patients is that the one thing they can always go to are citrus and fruit. They don't tend to change the taste as often as other foods do. So sometimes we can mask protein sources and those sorts of things with foods that taste as they should. A change in bowel function might be an issue. Now, I want you all to be communicating with your team if you have a change in bowel function. If you're having constipation, it may not be the same treatment, right, for why you may be having constipation as why somebody else who's not under active treatment having constipation. Blockages can cause issues. You don't want to just immediately go to your go-to method to address constipation, but talking with your team. Sometimes an appropriate method is increasing fluid, fiber, and even activity. Now, if you're in the other direction of diarrhea, again, talk with your team. Most important thing is to stay hydrated. But if you're having a lot of frequent stools, oftentimes you might be losing important electrolytes. And it's hard to get that by drinking water. So finding a good rehydrant such as Pedialyte, something that's lower in sugar but that is mimicking those losses that we lose in our GI system is a way to go until you can get that under control. We may have to modify fiber, temperature, even maybe reevaluating the sweet concentration in some of your foods. Even sugar alcohols can aggravate and cause more diarrhea. So there's a number of different things. But keeping a daily record can be helpful for the team being able to understand what you've been eating and how you're responding. But as a final point, remember talking with your healthcare team. Your goal is to maintain your weight and lean muscle mass and reach out to those that are there for you. With that, I'm going to close and hand this back over to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Bearden. That was really wonderful and very informative. A lot of very good tips for everybody. So thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Caroline Edlin. Ms. Edlin is an oncology social worker, and she is Cancer Care's online support group program director. And Ms. Edlin is going to present Cancer Care's free psychosocial services and programs and the role of support groups. It's now my pleasure to turn this program over to Ms. Edlin.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be part of this call today. And I'd like to start by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are many ways that we help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional supportive services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care programs include individual counseling, support groups, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are delivered by master's-level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends, and are experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, physical, and financial challenges that arise after a diagnosis. Adjusting to and dealing with a diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Cancer Care offers face-to-face groups in our local offices in the New York City area, as well as telephone and online support groups. These groups offer a unique opportunity to connect with other people impacted by cancer, along with the help of a Cancer Care social worker to facilitate the group. Sharing information and understanding with others in similar situations can be a powerful experience. Group members offer encouragement and a sense of community that can provide you with additional support and guidance. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. As we've learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and make sense of. Our social workers can help you understand what this means for you and your family. A Cancer Care social worker can help you prioritize and consider the questions that you might want to ask to get the answers and information you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care services are here to help you. So please do contact us at 1-800-813-HOPE or 4673 or log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about our oncology social work support. And thank you so much for your attention and the opportunity to speak today.
Well, thank you so much, Caroline. That was really wonderful and very helpful for people to know all the services that they can access from Cancer Care. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Candace to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions. Some of you are already doing this already, but if you could let everyone know how to queue up for questions, and we'll take as many of your questions as possible. If we don't get your questions, then I will actually explain to you before we end how to get your questions answered.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star and then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And our first question comes from Emil S. Your line is now open.
Hi. If you have a colonoscopy and endoscopy and have polyps removed and biopsied as precancerous, does that mean you will develop gastric cancer down the road?
Excellent question, Emil. Thank you. And Dr. Benson, would you please address that question?
So I think one of the important reasons we look for polyps and remove them is that often takes care of the problem. What's important is to discuss with the gastroenterologist when follow-up, either upper endoscopy or colonoscopy, should be performed. And that varies depending on a person's risk. But by careful surveillance with these scope procedures, we hope to identify these lesions that at least have the potential to become a cancer and remove them before they cause a problem. This does not mean just because a person has a polyp that they will, in the end, develop a cancer. But it is important, if you have a polyp, to have careful discussion with the gastroenterologist in terms of subsequent follow-up.
Excellent. Thank you. And our next question?
Again, ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question, please press star 1.
And we have a question from one of our online participants. I'm going to ask this question of Dr. Koo. What tests are usually necessary to confirm a gastric cancer diagnosis?
The most basic test really is to have a pathologist look at glass slides just to make sure that, you know, the cells are cancerous. And that probably is the most basic distinction. The pathologist can differentiate between, you know, normal tissue anywhere in the body and tissue that's cancerous. Beyond that, certainly the most standard test that we would do is the HER2 that we discussed. This is a relatively, for the most part, simple test and can come back in as little as 3 days to let us know whether the tumor cells have HER2 or not. Beyond that, I mean, there are an increasing number of other tests that we would consider, many of which are kind of more experimental at this time and not necessarily standard. But, you know, testing for PD-L1 to see if someone is a good candidate for immunotherapy, looking at kind of genetic testing of the tumor cells, these are all, you know, increasingly becoming more mainstream as well.
Thank you. And we have a question for Dr. Bakai Saab. So are stomach ulcers and gastric cancer linked? If you could just answer that question in a general way.
Yeah, in a general way, so let's think about it two ways. If you have a gastric ulcer, are you going to be at risk for stomach cancer? The answer is unlikely. And the reason why I don't say no, because there are certain immune diseases that can cause ulceration that could be linked to some form of gastric cancer, but not adenocarcinoma. On the other hand, gastric cancer itself can present as a gastric ulcer, meaning that the first symptom and sign of gastric cancer could be an ulcer, and then we call it a malignant ulcer because it has a little different appearance. It can be associated with a mass, but that usually is a diagnosis that's made at the time the patient has an endoscopy to assess the bleeding. So in some, you know, if you have a history of ulcers and no other issues, and ulcers are very common, that does not necessarily mean that this would be this will put you at risk for gastric cancer in the future.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you very much. And a question in front of our online participants regarding esophageal cancer and its treatment. And although this workshop is not on this topic per se, I believe. However, Dr. Benson, if you could address this question in a general way in terms of treatments for esophageal cancer.
So there are two basic cell types of esophageal cancer: squamous cell, which is far less common in the United States and often can occur more in the upper part of the esophagus. And in many cases, if patients have localized disease, they're treated with radiation and chemotherapy and may go on to have surgery. What is more common is an adenocarcinoma, and more typically, this is in the distal or the lower esophagus, and this is related to my discussion of the lower esophagus, the gastroesophageal junction, and the gastrocardia. So these individuals are treated much the same, and that often, more commonly now, incorporates chemoradiation followed by surgery. So also the etiology or the cause of squamous versus adenocarcinomas is often different, but the treatment approaches do have some similarities.
Awesome, thank you. And our last late-breaking question I'm going to give this to Dr. Koo. How have treatment options for gastric cancer changed recently?
Well,
I know we've discussed
this,
but just
Yeah, no, I would actually say that, you know, clearly this is a profoundly difficult disease for patients and their family members, but I actually think that probably for the first time ever, there are reasons to be optimistic. I think over the last 6 or 7 years, you know, trastuzumab was first approved for tumors that were HER2 positive, and, you know, ramucirumab was approved for all tumors in the second line setting. But I really think we're at the beginning of a change in how these cancers are treated with immunotherapy and potentially some other medications. And, you know, we see in other cancers already, probably lung cancer would be the closest counterpart, that the immunotherapy drugs are really transforming the treatment of lung cancer. And I think in the next couple of years, we'll see that with gastric cancer as well. You know, having said that, I mean, I think, you know, these immunotherapy drugs on their own, you know, the benefits remain modest in that only a small proportion of patients are helped. But for the patients who are helped by these medications, the durability of the benefit is much more than with chemotherapy. So I think, you know, the work that remains to be done over the next, certainly over the next 5 or 10 years, but possibly for much longer than that, is for us to begin to learn how to combine these immunotherapy drugs with other immunotherapy drugs, with chemotherapy, with radiation, with targeted therapies. So I really think this is, you know, the beginning of hopefully kind of steady progress in improving the outcomes in this disease.
Excellent. Thank you. And, well, there is one last late-breaking question. This will be the last question for Dr. Pekhai-Sab. So about clinical trial options for rarer types of gastric cancers, if you could comment on that question.
So, rare types of gastric cancer would be essentially the non-adenocarcinoma cancer. There's probably multiple flavors of these rare types. They go from the neuroendocrine tumors to the lymphomas, to a number of others. But overall, so depending on what the pathology is, what the identifier is, there may be a number of different clinical trials that would be available. Again, all depends on the pathology. So let's say, you know, the patient was found to have a gastrointestinal stromal tumor, GIST. The treatment is completely different, will not involve chemotherapy, will involve what we call targeted oral agents, and there are a number of studies that would be very different from the gastric adenocarcinoma. The same for the rare lymphomas and other pathologies as well. So, again, it all depends what the pathology is. Even for the rare tumors of the stomach, chances are there is a clinical trial ongoing.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. You have been outstanding, just really an outstanding team of physicians and our dietitian and oncology social worker, just a wonderful team of speakers today. And I also want to thank all of our participants who've asked really such great questions, and that's really makes all the difference in the world. Now, I had said that I would let you all know if you did have further questions, particularly medical questions, where you could get those answered. So I want to address that right away. If you have additional medical questions that you didn't get answered, of course you want to go to your healthcare team. They are, of course, the best people to, first of all, ask your questions because they actually, of course, have access to all of your medical records and all of that. However, some of you would like to call another place for just general information, and that would, I would say, to call the National Cancer Institute. And their toll-free number is 1-800-422-6237. Or you may visit their website at www.cancer.gov, and they actually have a live chat feature where you can actually pose your question in a live chat box and they will get back to you. You can chat back and forth with them and get your question answered in that way. So that would be available for international participants as well as for people in the United States as well. And so please, that's a wonderful resource. For those of you who'd like to take advantage of Cancer Care's oncology social work services, for practical and financial assistance, to join a support group, for additional counseling services, for someone to talk with, I would go ahead and call Cancer Care's counseling line at 1-800-813-4673. Or again, you may visit our website at www.cancercare.org, where you can pose your question as well or ask for help. So as we conclude our program today, the most important thing is we do not want any one of you to feel that you're alone in coping with cancer and coping with gastric cancer. We want you to now know that you're part of the cancer care world, and in that respect, you can contact us at any time. And also, I do want to remind you that we have a program coming up that may very well be of interest to some of you. It's called Living with Cancer Throughout the Cancer Journey, and that's on Friday, March 10th, and we encourage all of you to participate in that program, and that is taking place from 1:30 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time, so that may be of interest to some of you. And we have lots of other programs that you might choose to sign up for as well, but I just thought I would call attention to that one. So as we conclude today, I want to wish you all a very fine day, and thank you all for your participation.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.